So for this evening's Dhamma talk, I've just returned from teaching a retreat and other talks in Hong Kong. And I'm really surprised that even though that I haven't been there for 3 years, there's still so many people want to come and learn and listen to more Buddhism, more deep Dhamma. And sometimes you wonder in places like Hong Kong, there's so many other teachers, mostly the Mahayana teachings, and also lots of Christianity. So what is actually the difference between all of that and the Buddhism we teach here? What actually do we teach here? Is it attractive? If so, why? And I was just reflecting on the aircraft coming back that one of the reasons why I always find Buddhism appealing, it never actually tells you what to believe. It's not like, you have to believe in this, you have to believe in that, you have to believe in something else. And if you don't believe in that, you are criticized or you're expelled or whatever. It doesn't really tell you what to believe. It's more it tells you how to find out for yourself. And that is a very powerful sort of difference. And it's also the way of learning how to find it out for yourself, the answers to life, is something which everybody, each one of you here, can do. And what monks and nuns do is to train you so you can be able to have a powerful enough mind to discover these truths for yourself. And not to have the barriers to finding out truth for yourself. And of course, what that practice is a lot of mindfulness, but also with the kindness. When people do practice mindfulness, sometimes they're told how to do it way too much. You've got to do it this way and do it that way. And this is Ajahn Brahm's method of mindfulness, Ajahn somebody else's way of doing mindfulness, somebody else's. Are these all different? Or are they just different angles of the same thing? Find out for yourself by seeing what works. It's one of the reasons why at the end of every meditation I did ask you, how do you feel at the end of the meditation? Is it working for you? Do you feel more peaceful, more relaxed, even more healthy? Even going to places like Hong Kong, there's some people who have very difficult physical problems in their life. Of course, it is compounded by some of the emotional insecurities they may feel. But nevertheless, it still hurts and puts them in painful situations or difficult situations. So one of the things which we do learn is just how these things are caused. Not so much physically, but emotionally. It's sometimes quite weird. I think everybody knows that during the time there was a COVID virus. Why is it that some people could have that disease and they had hardly any symptoms? Other people had very heavy symptoms. Why is it that the same virus in two different people is actually experienced in different ways? One nice thing about that is to know that the physical body, the physical world doesn't totally dominate you. And hopefully the monks and nuns which you see can be examples of that. It's weird, but the monks and the nuns which you see here, we're all the poorest people in Australia. We do not have any bank accounts. We don't have any money. We don't have any superannuation. We don't have any pension fund. I've got no money hidden under my mattress. My mattress is too thin to hold any money. So in other words, we are legitimately penniless. Would you like to be penniless as well? Are you earning enough money? I'll certainly say that each one of you is earning much more than I am. But nevertheless, it's not so much the physical situation which you're in, but how we respond to that. even little things like, you know, some monks, we found out that Ajahn Bodhidharma, you know, was over in Switzerland looking after his mum, but his mother passed away a few days ago. And how does a monk relate to sort of a dear family member passing away? How is that different than any one of you? It's extremely different. All the monks which I've seen who've lost a parent, they tend to be kind of at ease with it. Somehow or other, the way they look at life means they're far more peaceful. Just to give you one indication of that, for example, when my mother passed away, I don't know about how many years ago now, 8 or 9 years ago, when she finally passed away, she had dementia for such a long time. And once she passed away, it was I felt kind of relieved and happy for her. Have you ever seen people with like dementia? Sometimes they don't remember who you are. I always thought that, I don't know, there wasn't that many. In fact, I was the only one who went into the old people's dementia ward or Alzheimer's ward, you know, with a bald head and a brown robe. I thought at least she would remember me, because I was different than everybody else. But no, she didn't even remember me at all. But I do recall when my grandmother had dementia too. I remember when I went to go and see her in a sort of a ward in UK, just outside of London. When I went in to see her, I went in there with my brother. My brother lives in London, and so he was looking after her, going to visit her every week. And I'd only go once every 3 or 4 years, whenever I could get into England, because I was busy here. I remember just going to see my grandmother, and as soon as she saw me, she recognized me straight away. But when my brother just was walking behind me, my grandmother said, "Who are you?" That really upset my brother. "I've been coming to see you every week, and this guy comes in, my brother comes in from Australia, only comes in once every year or two, and you remember him straight away." It's really unfair. But anyway, just one of the things which, you know, you learn, you know, when you sort of develop these ways of knowing and appreciating, was I felt that my mother was released from a prison. The prison of Alzheimer's. You know, not really knowing, you know, who's who, where to go, what to do. Now she was free. Fortunately, because I've been a monk for such a long time, I know exactly what's happening there. When the brain stops working, the mind can take over from that point. And that's one of the reasons why I have mentioned this several times. It's one part of medicine which I was really fascinated by, what is called terminal lucidity. That time when a person has been either in a coma or has dementia, Alzheimer's, or just drugged up with morphine at the end of life, and just before they pass away, they become aware and lucid. I don't know if he's here today, but one of the doctors who comes here, when I mentioned that a few years ago, he said he came and that experience happened to him just a few days earlier. One of his patients entered the dying process, and the patient had told him, if that happens, when it happens, there was a little booklet, you know, a notepad in the drawer next to his bedside, and said, "Just these are my relations. Please ring them up and tell them to come so they can be with me when I'm dying." And so he rang the first person and then the second person. When he got to his daughter, this man's daughter who was dying, Julie, said, "Please tell Julie that I'm dying. Please come as soon as possible." And that's when the fellow who was dying in the bed, who'd been unconscious for hours before, opened his eyes and said, "Please tell Julie how much I love her." And then he died. there was that amazing terminal lucidity, that break at the end of the life where they could hear, they could remember clearly and, you know, say things, important things. And I thought that was a, you know, really kind of beautiful example of why when the brain stops because of the body is dying or dead, then the mind can take over for a little while. Those are sorts of things which, okay, I'm going to tell this story. I was just thinking, should I tell this or should I not tell this? I read this in a book. Apparently it is a real story. It actually did happen in Adelaide some years ago. About this couple, they were in love and they decided to get married. And she arrived at the church, it was a church marriage, a little bit late. Because I know that I've conducted many marriage blessings in my life, and I know it's the custom even here for the wife to arrive, or the bride-to-be to arrive 5 minutes after she's supposed to arrive, just to set the tone of who's in charge in this marriage to come. But anyway, she arrived 5 minutes late and got out of the car with her father and found he hadn't arrived yet. You know, but you know, things, there are traffic problems, difficulties. So she was waiting there, and as the minutes went by, she became more and more concerned. And then even after 10 or 15 minutes, just really frantic. Maybe she'd been stood up. For some reason or another, the guy decided not to get married or something. So she was kind of relieved when, you know, she was looking down the road and saw him coming running towards her. It was him. And when, as soon as he got close enough, he said, "I'm sorry I'm late. I was in a car accident." And she could see that he had bruises and cuts on his face, and his suit was a little bit disheveled. He said, "Oh, we need to take you to hospital," she said. I remember the story, reading it, and it was just a powerful story. That's why I can recall all the details very clearly. So, take her to the hospital. He said, no, we're supposed to get married, let's go through with the marriage. I'm okay, I'll just go into the washroom, clean myself up, and let's do this. And that's what he did. And they did the marriage ceremony, you know, with all the vows, exchanging rings, everything, even to the kiss afterwards. And then, you know, sign the register, even sign the marriage register. And then they went into the car. She said, "I'll drive, you still look a bit shaken." To go to the reception, and everybody else followed behind. And that's what they did, they went alone, have a bit of time together, and then the cars following behind saw the car in front with the bride and the groom, the park by the side of the road. And the bride was outside of the car, sobbing hysterically. And when they pulled up, and the people in the family were going to the reception too. Where's he gone? And she said, "I was just driving the car, sitting next to him. And he just vanished. Totally disappeared." And they found out that that was the place where he had died in a car accident about an hour beforehand. It was a ghost story. A real one. He wanted to get married so much, it was such an important thing for him, that in Buddhism we call that he created a mind-made body, full with all its features, and solid enough to go to the wedding, to actually exchange vows, kisses, sign the register, and everything. That's how much he wanted to go through with that ceremony. I don't know if, I'm not making this up, because I know this is the power of your wanting, of your mind can actually do stuff like that. But anyhow, that when you understand just how this mind works, how do you understand how it works? How you understand how it works is you trust that your experience, your mindfulness together with the kindness, because what that does, it sometimes challenges, you know, your beliefs, challenges what you're taught. You see things in a totally different way. I'm not asking anyone to believe all of this, but to suggest such things are possible and true. So what happens is, we don't really tell people what to believe in Buddhism, but we challenge. And we give you the skills to find out and check these things out by yourself. After a while, now you find that your cognitive processes, what you see and what you interpret, what you see, what you hear and what you think you hear, you smell, taste, touch, what you know in the mind, how much of that is actually true? And how much is that what you want to believe? Or what actually you block off? And that can be very, very important. I remember there was one lady over in Armidale many years ago. And we used to have a little group down in Armidale, the Armidale Meditation Group. And one of her friends told me that she was in big trouble. And she wanted to have a private chat with me, which she did. And her trouble was that she had two children, maybe about 11 years of old at the time, and they were twins. And, you know, she'd come home from work and found the twins had been put in some social care program because the teachers had found out her two children had been abused by their father, sexually abused. And this woman, she was totally innocent, but felt so guilty. She was their mother. How come she never saw that, never noticed it, never protected her children? The teachers at the primary school could see it, but she couldn't. It took a bit of like counseling, but I mentioned to her, if you're in that situation, you know, to admit that what you're seeing, you'll always find some excuse to say, no, that's not happening. Because what the result of that was is destroying the whole family. You know, her lover, her husband, and just the problems that would mean with their kid. What we do is something so difficult to see, we block it out. That's a natural phenomenon for human beings. Sometimes any of you who've had any sort of relationship which, you know, becomes difficult, and has your partner ever told you, look, I've been telling you this for years, it's not working. Can you see it? Of course not. If it's not what you want to see, if it's something which is very challenging, we go into denial, we block it out from our mind. And I mention these things because if you want to really be wise, to know the truth of things, why is it we block things out so much? Why is it that people, you know, you suddenly get sick? Do you suddenly get sick? Or has the mind or the body been telling you for years that you're getting too stressed out, you're getting too tired, you're not looking after your health? Of course, a lot of times the body tells us. I remember reading a book many years ago about, you know, heart attacks. And they say that when people have a heart attack, it doesn't suddenly come out of the blue, some shock. They say the body tells you many times there's something wrong. But instead of actually following the body's warnings or, you know, a little bit of advice, instead of doing that, this is just too shocking for us, too difficult, too disturbing. So we literally block it out, we deny it. And that is something which has fascinated me for so many years. How much stuff do we block off? We say, oh no, it's not a problem at all. Anything which we don't like to see is hard for us to see. We, you know, we'd prefer not to see it. And of course, one of those examples, one of my favorite examples, just to show how powerful this is, was that little experiment which was done at Imperial College in London. Imperial College in London was one of the really sort of strong scientific, technological universities as part of London University. I remember just going to give a talk there years ago, and when I gave a talk there, one of the head of the Buddhist Society at Imperial College, he told me when he first went to that college in London, it's right next to the museums, when he first went there, he got lost in that particular college. And he walked down some stairs where he shouldn't have been walking down. And he said that that was the area which was run by the government. So where they did some very secret experiments. So when he was found, he was very quickly marched out again. I never realized had that sort of stuff going on underneath the main university, but apparently there was. But also, this particular experiment was done by some Buddhists about levitation. Have ever you seen levitation? A monk rising up into the air? Have you seen that? Of other objects rising up into the air? This was a scientist, a physicist, who said he discovered the secret of levitation and was going to demonstrate it, not just to the media, but to his fellow scientists, to professors and lecturers and experimental physicists especially at one of the top universities. And he said that they could have as many cameras and machines or whatever to make sure that this was real. It was recorded, it was filmed in ultraviolet, infrared, ordinary cameras, the whole lot. And so when the experimenter, the main physicist, came in, lots of scientists were there. He brought in a flower pot. He carried it in himself, no strings, put it on the bench. For those of you who've been into these science laboratories, you can see it's a big old wooden bench. Put it on the wooden bench and said, "We're now going to levitate this flower pot." And he said, "I needed other people's help." All he wanted was the professors to create the correct atmosphere by chanting the Hindu holy word Om. And all these professors, old bearded crusty professors, all started chanting Om, 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 Om. At first they thought it was a bit of a joke, but then the flower pot levitated. It rose up into the air. They photographed it, filmed it. It actually did lift into the air. And when it came down again, they asked these professors, lecturers at university, experimental physicists, they asked them what they thought about this amazing experiment. And some of those professors replied, "What are you talking about? That flower pot was on the table all the time." They said it never lifted even a millimeter off the table. It never levitated. Levitation is impossible. It didn't work. And even when they showed them the photographs, "Oh, those photographs were faked." Showed them the video. "Oh, that's just been, what do they call it these days? Just been dubbed or photoshopped or whatever." And they thought it never happened. It did happen. It did rise above the table. And then they disclosed why it rose above the table. There was a huge electromagnet installed underneath the table, and it took such a strong electric current to make the electromagnet work. And I think you all know, once you turn on a strong electric current, there's always the hum of the alternating current. So they all had to go ohm, 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 just to hide the electric current, otherwise they'd discover the reason straight away. But the point was that it had risen above the table, but some of those experimental physicists blocked it out of their awareness. They never even saw it. Their eyes saw it, but when it went from their eyes into their brain to be processed, it was blocked. They did not see it. When I read that and discussed it with my friends, you understood how much of what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or know, how much of that is twisted and blocked, because some of it is just too challenging for us to admit to. One of the wonderful things about this path of Buddhism is that after a while our awareness and our kindness become so strong, it's strong and courageous enough to see what is real, what is true. We're not going to bend anything anymore. Don't you really want to know the truth? What's real? Because if one doesn't understand what is real, what is, you know, true, in the end, there's always something in the back of the mind saying, this is not right, this is not good, something's wrong here. So part of our path of Buddhism is learning how to be mindful, kind and courageous. How does that courage actually work? It is to sometimes the mindfulness, the mind becomes so still and peaceful that you're almost like tolerance to being challenged, gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And this is not being challenged by theories or by logic. I used to spend hours, you know, discussing with my friends at Cambridge what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's false. And these were people with amazing brains. But then you would never get anywhere. Just through logic or reason wasn't strong enough. You wanted to have experience. Does this actually, is this real? It's only that experiential knowledge or wisdom or seeing was convincing. And that's one of the reasons why when your mind is still, you start to see things which other people haven't seen. To experience things which are real, which other people just haven't managed to admit to. These are the things which once you are taught how to be mindful and courageous enough, you can actually change the way you look at the whole of life and yourself. The nice thing which I can promise you is that it gives you far greater sense of freedom and joy and peace in your life when you get much closer to the truth of things. Sometimes we think we know, but we don't. When I was in Hong Kong, I told the people there a story which I usually only tell on retreats. And it was a simile of the tadpole and the frog. Once upon a time, oh, first of all, if you're sitting comfortably, then I'll begin. Once upon a time, there was a little tadpole, and she grew up in a little pond next to the monastery. And as she was growing up, in that pond, there was a little school for tadpoles. And she did very well at school and went to high school in the pond. And she became, she graduated, with a lot of skills in chemistry and hydrology. And there was even a university in that pond. So she went to university and studied hydrology. And after getting a Bachelor of Arts or Science, then she got a PhD in hydrology. She became an expert in water. And because it was a monastery, often she could hear the monks discussing the Abhidharma, the nature of water. So she became so expert in the nature of water. Was she? She knew all the theories and ideas of what water was, but she'd been born in water, lived all her life in water, knew nothing except water. Can she really understand what water was? Of course not, no more than a fish could. Even all the studies, all the lectures, all the discussions, all the reasoning, all the books, can you really understand what water is? But one day little tadpole was different than a fish, because one day little tadpole grew legs and arms. She started changing into a frog. And one day little tadpole, now little frog, she didn't know what she was doing, but she kind of jumped. And then she was outside of the lake, on dry land. That was weird, a bit scary. She never experienced anything like that in her whole life. But now she was squatting on dry land. Something which had always been there was now missing. Water. That's the only time a tadpole, now a frog, can know what water is. That's the same as many of the things which we live with all the time. Do we really understand what they are? Do we understand what life is? Do we understand even what the seasons really are? Do we understand what our body is? What love is? Do we understand what peace is? Do we understand what life and death is? Do you think you can really understand what your body is until one day the body just disappears? You're there, but this body is gone. Am I talking about death? No. It's a bit late to find out the truth of life when you die. I'm talking about even earlier than that, when you're meditating and your body gets so still you can't feel it anymore. You can't hear sounds. You can't taste, smell, or the whole physical body, the five senses, have become very still. What's left? What's left? You're still very aware. That awareness is still, it's inside. You know what many people I teach this, I don't mind teaching this. I don't know if this is why you came today, but this is what you're getting. sometimes I was just a young student when I started meditating. I didn't know too much what I was doing. It just felt good. And there's something about just, the way of meditation. I never had to pay any money for it. It wasn't sort of, I didn't even need to sign my name down. But, it felt good. That's one of the reasons why at the end of each meditation, again, I ask you, how do you feel? There's something about, your ability to know truth. You may not know it fully, but this meditation is brilliant for your health. That's why many people like in the Solaris Cancer Group, which I go and teach every year, they love, learning some meditation. What happened in my own life, the times I was really sick, using meditation more than anything else to heal, and seeing it with other people. So often you see people with these weird diseases, you teach them some meditation and disease goes. Weird diseases. And I'd love it if some people would do some deeper experiments or research into the power of deep meditation and how that affects your health afterwards. I don't mind telling you, I think I've told this story so many times, I'm not revealing any secrets, that there was one of the diseases I had, one of the worst illnesses I've ever had, was scrub typhus. Same symptoms as typhoid fever. That was in northeast Thailand. And I've never ever in my life been so devoid of energy. I was only a young man at this time, I think maybe 24, 25. And in this hospital, we didn't have any much care. We didn't even have bedpans. So if you need to go to the toilet or to urinate, you had to work your way over to the toilet. The monks, with the best luck, had the beds closer to the toilet, didn't need so far to go. You know, in those old wards, maybe about 6 beds on either side. And I was on one of the end beds. So to get to the toilet, I remember, you had to get up and use the metal railings on the side of the bed to hold on and then build up your energy and almost like fall onto the next bed, move yourself along and do the next to fall to the next bed to get closer and closer to the toilet. So when I did get to the toilet, I made sure I was done before I made the long trip back. And I just remember just laying there, having no energy at all. It was a fever for many days, and the doctors and nurses didn't know what the fever was. The reason for that was because according to the health department in Bangkok, there was no scrub typhus up in the northeast of Thailand. There was, but the reason they didn't know, because the locals had immunity. It was only the white monks going there would catch it. And that was why eventually they found out. But anyway, just in that bed feeling just so terrible as a young man, but no energy at all. And nothing worked. So I decided to, one afternoon or morning, I forget which, just to meditate. I know that some people say, well, the body hurts. It was hurting all over with a fever. You got no energy, you're sick, you're in a fever. Yes, I know, that's what it's like. But it didn't stop me meditating. Once you know how to meditate, you don't need to focus on something. You just need to let go of things. Imagine the idea of focusing on something, that's too much energy and effort. There's no way I could do that. We can let go of everything else. When you let go of everything else, that's all you've got left. How do you focus on the present moment? You just let go of past and future. It's much easier that way. How do you become silent? You just let go of naming things and thinking. How do you become still? By let go of all this idea of trying to get somewhere else. The more you let go, the more the same thing which people aspire for in meditation, focus, stillness, peace, they come quite naturally. So I remember just getting this beautiful meditation, really amazingly blissed out. And just a few minutes before, I don't know how many of you have had a fever, a very bad fever, and you've had it for so many weeks, you feel totally exhausted. That's how I felt. And just the contrast was immense. And so that when he came out of that, I was young, so I didn't really know what was going on. But nevertheless, I'm pretty sure that's where the fever broke. When that happens to you, wouldn't you like to share it with other people? How that can work? And it was nothing to do with any medication. Everything to do with the peace and stillness which you had in your mind. Oh, and I must mention the posture. I've read many books and been told by many gurus when I was young, you have to sit this way, cross your legs, right leg over the left leg, right hand over the left hand, thumb slightly touching, straight back, chin down, that's the right posture. Even sometimes put your hands on your knees, that's the right posture, full lotus. The posture which I was in when I did that meditation was one leg this way, another leg that way, an arm over here. Have you ever seen anyone in hospital really sickly? They don't know how they're, what they're supposed to be doing. It's all over the place. But nevertheless, it worked. And that really taught me a lesson in about the postures of meditation. What works is your mind is the most important part of that. It challenged. And that's one of the nice things about Buddhism, the Dhamma, always being open to that challenge. See what happens. See what can be done. So with the mindfulness, the awareness, that is like the flashlight where you can see where you're going. But you know, most people's mindfulness is so worn out that our mindfulness is very weak. I'm saying that seriously. You may think, oh, you just do mindfulness, that's easy, but no. After a while, you learn how to strengthen that mindfulness. So it's not just a flashlight, it's one of these big searchlights which sometimes the military use. You can see things such a long way away. Incredible powerful light. When you want to see deeply into things, you do need powerful light. And that's actually what it really feels like. Sometimes your mind is incredibly strong. If you want to penetrate things you've never seen before, you need that strong mindfulness and awareness. I said this little phrase, I probably say this once every couple of weeks, from William Blake, the English poet. To see a world in a grain of sand, see a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. The whole idea of seeing a world in a grain of sand. Most people would not see anything in a grain of sand, they'd just pass over it, there's more important things to see. But sometimes your mind becomes so strong, even a grain of sand you look at, wow, so much in there. This is where we see truths which we've never seen before. Heaven in a wild flower. You know, West Australia is known for its wild flowers. We have a wildflower season. They're tiny flowers. But sometimes if your mind is strong, you can look at it and you can see incredible beauty in there. This is where we find out what beauty really is. I've been very serious all this time today. Can I tell a gross story? Many of you know what this story is, but here it comes again. It was an important story because one of the followers, who was a fundamental particle physicist, still is, over in CERN, that's the big atom smasher in France and Switzerland. He said this was such an important story for him. It was gross, but so important because this is where he discovered what beauty is. And this was the time when I was teaching a meditation retreat over in China Grove. And there's another one starting just on Thursday. But when I teach, I also practice. I don't just go up there and tell you what the books say. I tell you what I see. So I was meditating, really nice meditations, but then you need to go to the toilet. When I went to the toilet, I still remember the toilet cubicle, it's number second, the middle toilet cubicle in the monks, not the monks, in the men's toilets opposite the laundry. Went in and sat down, and did what we call a number two. And when I did that, when I looked in the toilet bowl afterwards, it blew my mind. I've never, ever seen such a beautiful piece of shit, ever. I don't know, you've heard that so many times, but you still find it funny. Why not? Have you ever seen what you do in a toilet bowl and just looked at it as if it's one of the most beautiful things in the whole world? I wasn't going crazy. I'm not mad. But it looks so beautiful. Next time you have a look. Different shades of brown. It's not the same. And the way that those little balls are all put together, it's like, I don't know why you're laughing, it's because it was like a sculpture by Rodin or Michelangelo or something. And then the fragrance. You see, why do you laugh there? Because this is not supposed to be beautiful. It's not supposed to be fragrant. You've been told all your life, by starting from your mother, your father, your teachers, you're not supposed to regard this as beautiful. It's a piece of shit. But it did look beautiful. One of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. This is what happens. What is beauty? Beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. It's in what the mind adds to what you're experiencing. That's where it lies. Once you discover that, it's amazing just how you can have some experience in your life. Say, you know, you lose your job. Say you have a breakup in the marriage, someone close to you dies. And you can change that perception to see it's so beautiful. That's what I did when my father died. I wasn't sad at all. He was such a beautiful, wonderful man. I learned so much from him. It was like the end of a great concert. I never cried. I felt like clapping and shouting, "Bravo, bravo, what a great life you've lived." Seeing things in a totally different way, in a good way, in a much more positive way. When some of the monks had COVID before, in the COVID times, I encouraged them, "You've got a free retreat for 7 days. Enjoy. Why not?" When somebody gets depressed, what does it feel like being depressed? Understand it, feel it in the body, feel it in the mind, be mindful of it. Be kind to it. Have fun with it. That's almost like forbidden. How can you enjoy being depressed? I still remember this one guy in the Armadale group. You know, he needed a special instruction because he was depressed. I said, "Well, what do you do this morning?" And he said, in the morning, because he was depressed, his family allowed him to have 2 tubs of ice cream. He liked his ice cream. He said, "Look, if you are healthy, no one would let you eat ice cream in the morning. And 2 tubs? I said, "Yeah." "Was it nice?" "Oh yeah, it was delicious." I said, "Great. Now look, you're probably going to get out of depression very quickly, but don't tell your doctor, don't tell your family, otherwise that's the end of the ice cream." He said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." We were having some fun with this. Adding beauty to what many people say, you know, it's not beautiful. That is actually how you challenge what you're taught, what you're supposed to believe in, how you're supposed to experience this world. Even when going over to Hong Kong, in Hong Kong the weather was really nice, it's rainy, but it was just about 22, 23 degrees most of the time. But when I went over to Norway, just that was over in November or December, it was snowing over there. Really cold. So what do? You change the perception of what cold is like. And I mentioned to many people, one of my experiences which I remember, which was wonderful, was walking out from one of these Rocker Flats apartments. It was only a short walk, maybe a couple of hundred meters, when it was snowing. I did have a woolly hat, but I took it off because I wanted to enjoy the feeling of fresh snow falling on my head. It was like very light petals of snow. Have you ever seen the snowflakes? They're actually gorgeous. As it was falling on my head, there was not enough thermal mass in one snowflake to take away the heat from my head. And it was actually one of the most pleasant experiences I've ever had. Just allowing the snow to fall on your bald head. There's a couple of people with no hair on here. You'd enjoy it, it's wonderful. Those of you who've got hair, you're going to miss out on one of the most beautiful experiences of life. You see, I think you can get the feeling of what the talk is all about. How you're experiencing things which no one else has told you about. How you're challenging perceptions and ideas, seeing things for yourself, and expanding ideas of beauty and kindness and love. What is love anyway? I've often said the greatest act of love is letting somebody go. It's what I did for my mum and my dad when they died. You let them go with my blessing. I don't want you to suffer anymore, dad, mum. Be free. Go. Not because I wanted to get rid of them. I valued all those years I had with them. I never forgot those. But please go. Be free. The greatest act of love is to let somebody go. And so that's one of the reasons why that I care for each one of you. I love each one of you. So now is the time to let you go. Thank you for listening. Excellent. Any questions from anybody on the floor before we do the questions online? Your hand is wiggling. Eddie? Yeah, I can hear you, yeah. What is it? Go on. Okay.
Ajahn Brahm. Oh, sorry. You made a very, very important talk tonight. I don't know whether people catch it or not.
You reckon?
The way I catch it is, okay, you mentioned of the, before we have the big problem, we ignore warning signs, you know.
Oh,
before the big problem comes. Yeah, and then you talk about the ways to overcome things, like through meditation, through the mind. Yeah. Can I share with you the people for the angle I look into, you know?
Okay, be quick. Don't share the anger. Share the way out of the anger.
Yeah, yeah. So.
For
me, okay. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. Whenever a problem comes to me, you know, all right, I always remember, you know, I don't know whether this is in the sutta or not, okay. Our problem, 80% of it is from our mind, you know, mind. The other 20% is from the weather, change in weather conditions. The food we eat, and our karma, you know. Okay, yeah. So what I mean is, what is the problem in me, you know? So could it be the weather? It could be the weather, this thing, then, it could be the food we eat, or no. A lot of it is from the karma, from our thinking, you know, like what you say just now, Ajahn Brahm.
Yeah.
The wrong thinking that builds up over time, you know. Then it affects, in the mind, over matter, you know, affects our the energy in the body, all these things, and the problem comes. Like what you mentioned too in your talk just now.
Yeah, You're not seeing clearly.
Yeah, not seeing clearly, you know. So we don't realize we harbor this negative energy, you know. Like, for example, hatred of someone, you know, all these things, you know. Revenge, jealousy, all this, you know. So slowly it builds up, and then we... So the thing is, realizing this, we change the situation, you know.
Yes.
I find it myself, you know, and I find that it goes off, this thing. And if a heavier thing, which I can't could be karmic thing, I come to the temple here, I get, that's me, you know, help from Devas.
Good.
And that helps.
Excellent. Thank you.
See what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I just, because I gave a longer talk than usual, I better go through these five questions here. So, we got a question from Germany. How can you let, I saw in the news that Prince Charles is in Germany, or King Charles. It says from Germany. I wonder if this is from King Charles. How can you let go of the past if memories keep popping up? How does Buddhism deal with the concept of subconscious? Can we make peace with it? Is intuition part of it? Crikey, that's a lot of questions. But first, if memories keep popping up, please be kind to the past. Forgive it. Be kind to all the people who played their bit in creating your past. Not just other people, but yourself as well. And when you're kind to all those beings, it's much easier to let go of the past. If there's some ill will there, some anger, then it's almost impossible to let it go. So be kind to it all. And the concept of subconscious, you become aware of the subconscious. In deep meditation, you can become aware of everything. Can we make peace with it? Of course, you make peace with everything. Is intuition part of it? People call it intuition, but it's like a deeper sense of knowledge and understanding. Anyway, next one, a question from Sri Lanka. How can I stop the phone addiction and benefits of doing other activities? Thank you. Throw away your phone. You know, if you can't throw away your phone, now sometimes, have you ever seen me answering a mobile phone? Actually, I do have a mobile phone number. It's on a tablet which I have in my room. Hardly ever use it, and there's no way I'm going to let any of you know that number. So, you don't have to use it. Sometimes when you go on retreats, it's a lovely thing to be able to hand in your phone. You give it to me, I'll look after it for you. I won't check your answer or anything. But if you think, no, something important might happen, you can give your relations and friends the number of the retreat manager with the instruction. Anything important, tell the retreat manager, and then they can let you know to get your phone and to answer it. But you don't need to have your own mobile phone. You can be free for 9 days. It's only 9 days. And I guarantee that... Okay, so grab her mobile phone and don't give it to her until the 9 days are over. And you actually find, oh, what a wonderful gift that is. You're free. You don't have to worry about a thing. Nothing goes wrong. I guarantee you'll be fine. From Dam CW. Ajahn, I do believe that everything we chase in lay life is subject to anicca, dukkha and anatta. But why do I still look for those pleasures? How can I overcome these habits and uproot our desires? If you want to go that deep in the meditation has to be so peaceful that there's no way in the world you'd ever want to disturb that peace. You value the peace so much. Why disturb it with getting things? You know, lots of times we spend our whole life trying to amass things. How much time do you spend trying to get rid of things? Getting rid of things is far more fun. Try it. Live a simple life. How many of you have seen where I live? My cave. How much stuff is inside my cave? I must admit that, you know, not many caves have electricity. have a nice, what is it, cork tile floor. That's about it. I've got a water bottle in there. And it's so simple, it's so nice. Yeah, I do have a little mattress where I sleep on and a pillow. That's all you have. It's so wonderful to have that joy of having a few things. You know, when I was in Hong Kong, they put me up in a nice hotel. I don't remember that nice hotel as much as I remember just for one lunch hour, hour and a half. They took me into the forest in Hong Kong, and they said, take a rest on this rock in the middle of the forest. It's a lovely place to meditate for an hour and a half. And that's one of the best memories of Hong Kong, being in the middle of a forest alone on this rock, just meditate for an hour and a half. I kind of remember that's where I belong, not in a hotel room, but in the forest. I'm being honest with you there. So how do you overcome these habits? By realizing that whatever you chase in life is not worth as much as the freedom from chasing. It can sometimes be so discouraging to practice day in, day out, and then encounter the absolute craziness of humanity that appears to be getting worse and more deluded. How to not lose focus? Once I gave a simile of this alien coming down to visit Australia, and then coming down and looking, say, at what life was like 10 years ago. And then coming down right now and seeing what life is like. Yes, it may be that some things have changed, but the general nature of human beings is pretty much the same. You know, for many years when I was in Thailand as a forest monk, you didn't know what was going on. You didn't have any newspapers, no radio, certainly no TVs. And so when you did see, like a Time magazine, I think I got once, and I saw, actually, the world hasn't changed. There's always a war somewhere, there's always corruption, there's always, you know, some people get, you know, too ahead of themselves, you know, film stars, really wealthy people. The names change, the places change, but basically the story is always the same over the years. Things are getting worse. Why not look back, say, 70 years ago? What was going on like 75 years ago? Had the Second World War going on? Oh, maybe 80 years ago. The Second World War going on. That was pretty desperate. There were nuclear bombs going off. So I think we've improved. But if it hasn't changed, then what's the purpose of all this? It's like, I mean, the main simile was the alien comes down and visits a school and sees the kids in the school 10 years ago, and then comes down 10 years later and sees the kids in the school. It all looks the same. They're still learning their alphabet and just how to do science and how to count. They don't realize that many of the kids they saw 10 years ago have now moved through the system and graduated. They're not in school anymore. It's the same with this world as well. You may think that we haven't changed, but we have. The old people before have now gone through and move through and become wiser. Last question. When a young person dies, does that mean they had killed other people or animals in their previous lives? Of course it doesn't mean that. Could have been. But you know, just it means if a young person dies, that sometimes if we don't understand and accept, you know, rebirth, this is one life amongst many, it does become very sad. Even like meaningless. How come a young kid just dies in such a, you know, few years of age? It's unfair. But of course, as Buddhists, Sometimes people ask me, do I believe in reincarnation, rebirth? I said, no, I don't. I know it. It's different. And so you know that when a person dies young, they have another chance. Sometimes I call it like you're traveling overseas and you go to the airport and you find the flight has been overbooked. You get bumped off. You haven't got a seat in the aircraft. Then what happens? You usually get offered a seat in the next available flight with an upgrade. And I think that that's a good description of what happens if a young person dies. They get an upgrade in the next life to make up. Anyway, thank you all for listening. It's now just almost 9:10. So if you have any more questions, which I'm sure many of you have, you can form a line in front here as you usually do. So now I'm going to pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and you're more than welcome to stay a bit longer if you wish.
Oops. There we go.
Arahaṁ sammasambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṁ namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami